Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Amy Bender, whose most recent novel is The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. We'll also catch up with former Times-Picayune reporter Keith O'Brien, who has a wonderful new book called Outside Shot: Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness. And we'll hear from children's book author Cornell Landry, who has a new seasonal treat, The Amazing Adventure of Mardi Gras Beat Dog. Amy Bender teaches at the University of Southern California at Los Angeles. She is the author of four books, the short story collections The Girl in the Flammable Skirt and Willful Creatures, and two novels, An Invisible Sign of My Own and The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Amy will be visiting New Orleans this week as the Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at Tulane University. She's speaking to us from her home in Los Angeles. Hi, Amy. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, Susan, thank you for having me.
Now, whenever I reel off the titles of your books to folks, the one that always catches people's attention is The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. When you came up with that title, you must have known you just had it.
Well, what's funny is it was actually a very collaborative process because it was a book that started with a different title, and as has happened before with me, when you kind of have a different title in mind, it's really hard to make the shift. So my editor and my agent and I were each kind of contributing a word. So we started with cake, and I liked cake, and then my editor suggested lemon cake because that was in the first chapter, and I think my agent came up with sadness and I came up with particular, so it was like Legos or something. We were building the title block by block.
So everybody had a little piece of it. That's wonderful.
Now, it was unusual, yeah.
Birthday cake in your, and birthdays in general in your books can be pretty fraught.
It's true, and I think there's something I'm drawn to about these markers of time, these kind of markers that are so meaningful but basically invented in a certain way, and how they tell us something about maybe the environment and the character and what point of life that character's in. But yeah, they are often very fraught.
And such transitional moments, you know.
Yeah.
You have a birthday where a mother kicks a daughter out of the house, which
yeah.
I kind of loved. So anyway, they're really fascinating. Now, this is a food town, so New Orleanians are really going to take your work to heart. So talk a little bit about the main character in The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake and what her special gift is.
It's at the same birthday that we're talking about that she is kind of overcome by all these tastes in a slice of birthday cake that her mother has made for her, and realizes slowly that she's picking up on the kind of unspoken or unseen feelings in the chef. So then she has this access into the other person's emotional life that she doesn't really want and feels way too young to process. So food becomes, for the character, a very also fraught medium because it's not really food anymore. It's packed with all this information, emotional information, you know, other historical information about where the food came from. And part of it, I think, we're in such a food time that it was on my mind a lot to just be thinking about food and where it came from. But I was sort of interested in twisting that a little bit and thinking about where it might come from that would be less positive or less organic, say.
Because so many of our memories of food are our most dramatic memories.
Yeah. I mean, I associate food with people, so it's often a very social presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with family dinners, with big events, with intimate romantic dinners, it's kind of a witness to a lot of our big moments.
And yet for Rose, this kind of what some would think is a wonderful gift isn't always so wonderful and makes her really sad a lot of the time and isolates her. And one of the things I notice in your novels is that there is a lot of sadness there.
I think it's true, and it's interesting because it's not deliberate, but I do think whatever motivates a writer is not necessarily known to that writer. In fact, I'd say generally it's not. You're driven in some way to sit down and write something, but a lot of the time I think the intention is a little masked. And so I think it's just become clear for me that there's something about the discussion of sadness, of trying to illuminate something about loss, that's repeatedly compelling to me and meaningful to me to try to write about in different ways. So it's not deliberate, but it just shows up.
And I've had these conversations with people, and we talk about how Americans in particular kind of shun sadness.
Yeah.
And run away from it. And when
yeah.
it's something you have to experience, really.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's such a necessary piece of things. But I think it was a couple years ago I was reading about funerals that were, I mean, it's interesting for New Orleans because funerals are a bit celebratory in New Orleans. But
oh,
in a very. But like in a gorgeous way, right? But there's something, I think they had just talked about it as like funerals that were all kind of positive thinking, upbeat funerals, which did seem to be skipping a major portion, which is just the pureness of grief, which is incredibly painful.
Oh, the new celebration of life tendency, I think, is what you
were saying. Yeah. The, like, look at the bright side to such a point that the dark side gets no consideration.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, you've looked at the dark side in other ways, too. I have to say, you wrote this essay on your closet office.
Oh, yes.
For
yes.
O Magazine, which
yes.
I loved because you talked about the difference between light and dark spaces for writers.
Yeah. It's also, it's very individual, but I'm drawn to a kind of smaller, more dark space as a more creative space, like a little womb-like kind of space, as opposed to occasionally someone will say they have a beautiful writing studio and they're looking out on a meadow and it's all lovely, and to me that feels absolutely not creative at all because all I'm going to do is long to run around in the meadow. And I think it's E.L. Doctorow that has a quote of something like the window is in the language. So basically your window is through the words into the story. And so an actual window doesn't allow you necessarily to do that as much. I mean, I think a window is nice.
A window is nice. But sometimes some good things came out of your time in that dark closet.
They did. There were some dark stories that came out of there, even though the closet itself was uncomfortable and I was happy to leave it. But I think I did write some of the scarier stories that I've written mm-hmm. in there.
Now, one of the other things you've said is that the Grimm's fairy tales have been an important influence on your work. And I've recently gone back to reading fairy tales myself. And I worry these days that we don't really see kids reading them the way probably
yeah.
you and I did when we grew up.
Yeah. I teach a fairy tale class at USC, and we go around the circle on the first day to say what is everyone's favorite fairy tale, and I'd say a good 95% say a Disney movie. So that's their access point, is usually Beauty and the Beast or Little Mermaid or one of those. And a few of them have read the tales. But then, like Philip Pullman, who wrote The Golden Compass, that mm-hmm. trilogy, which is fantastic, he just did it like a new translation of the complete Grimm's tales. So in a way, maybe that's going to get a few readers interested that love his other writing.
Now, I've read, too, that you teach a course, The Writer in the Community.
So that course is kind of designed to think about what does it mean to teach creative writing, because I think it's true of a lot of writers that it's often the thing you're doing with writing is teaching writing in some way. And so we go a half a block away from campus to a school, and the undergrads kind of build a curriculum together, and then they come and teach it to the third, fourth, fifth graders who then do a lot of writing and put together a little anthology of their work. So it's kind of a three-tier layer cake or something where I'm teaching them about writing and they're teaching the kids about writing, but then we all watch these fourth graders write their stories, and they're so free. They're so, like, wonderfully loose that everyone, I think, feels inspired by that.
Well, you seem free to me in that way. I mean, you're not a writer so much associated with place as a feeling of entering a different place.
Well, thank you.
You know what I mean?
I'm glad. No, I'm delighted. I think that's when the work is going well, is when I can tap into that place. But there are plenty of days where I feel like I'm, you know, twiddling my thumbs, not able to access it. So I want to kind of find as many permission givers as I can in the world. And a fourth grader is, you know, Picasso is a great permission giver, and so is a fourth grader writing about Mars.
Oh, and it's fourth graders are easy to surround yourself with, you know.
Yeah, right. Picasso's a little hard.
Oh, so what will you be reading while you're here?
I think I'll probably read a short story because there's something nice about it being contained with an ending. And I'm working on a new collection of stories, which should be out in the fall, so maybe something from there.
Oh, yay. Please. That would be lovely.
Thank you.
Well, you can meet Amy Bender while she's the Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at the Newcomb College Institute at Tulane University. She'll present a public reading Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. in the Freeman Auditorium at Tulane. Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, thank you, Susan. That was fun.
Keith O'Brien is a former reporter for the Boston Globe, as well as for the Times-Picayune, and a graduate of Northwestern University. He's here to talk about his first book, Outside Shot, Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Susan. Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. This is a story of basketball in Scott County, Kentucky, and a story of, as you say, big dreams and hard times. What drew you to rural Kentucky in the first place?
Well, it started with a simple idea. There remains basically one state left in this country, Kentucky, where it's single-class basketball. So no 5A, no 4A, no 3A. In Kentucky, there is one state tournament. There is one state champion. 16 teams go to Rupp Arena every March. Crowds of 20,000 come out to see these boys play. And as I learned of that and began to read about it, I just thought, I need to go there and I need to tell this story.
And you tell this story through the lives of four young players and their coach, Billy Hicks. How did you choose the players you chose?
Well, it started when I chose Scott County. When I decided I wanted to do this book, I met with multiple coaches to try to feel out what is the best community, what is the best team. And when I met with Billy Hicks, the head coach of Scott County, in his gymnasium in March of 2009, I left the gym that night and I just knew that he was the right person for this. He was colorful. He was open. He said to me when I walked out of the gym that night, you can come down here and write whatever you want. I've got nothing to hide. And I went to my car and I thought, I believe him. So once I had gone there, of course, there's about 12 boys on a basketball team. So you've got a group of 12 to work with. And it was clear from the get-go that some players were going to be stars of this team. So, of course, they're going to be characters. But one boy that I, as a main character of this book, was not a star. Will Hsu was essentially a bench warmer. And he had been passed over by a lot of these boys who had moved into his county. Some say recruited to play for his high school basketball team. And his story, of course, spoke to me because he was not a star. But he had given his whole life to play for Scott County, to wear that Cardinals jersey. And here, he was not going to get that opportunity, or not certainly not going to get it to the extent he thought he would. And so I knew he would also be a character as well.
He was the hometown boy. He really was. And tell us about Dakota Uten. He's one of the guys who moved in, right?
Dakota is one of the guys who moved into Scott County. Some say was recruited to play at Scott County. Dakota, when he was 16 years old, was playing basketball in Ashland, Kentucky, which is a small town on the Ohio River up near the West Virginia border. It's essentially Appalachia. And he was 6'8". He was over 200 pounds. He has the skills of a European big man, which means he could go inside and rebound and do that kind of dirty work, but he could also pull the ball outside and shoot three-pointers all day. And of course, 6'8", 16 years old, college coaches from around the country, they all wanted him to play for him. And so Dakota ended up being recruited by University of Kentucky, and he chose to go there. But by the time I moved there for his senior year, the coach who had recruited him had been fired, and Dakota was no longer going to be recruited by University of Kentucky. In fact, he was no longer being recruited by any schools of that caliber because he was still just 6'8". Now, I say just 6'8", that sounds like it's nothing, but people thought he was going to grow and be 7 feet tall.
But that's part of what this story is about, is how quickly things can change,
absolutely,
you know, and how things hinge on surprising things, you know, the futures of these young men. And tell a little bit about Jalon. He's one. Is that how you pronounce his
Jalon.
Name? Jalon. Jalon struck me as one of the characters you had a big, big heart for.
I do. I mean, I'm attached and invested in all of these characters. But Geelon's story is powerful. His father, when I moved there, was a garbage man in Lexington. He's very poor, his family was. Lots of siblings, not much in his home. I went to Geelon's home the first day of his basketball season and was invited in to spend the whole day with Geelon. And I went into the living room, and there was no furniture. There were a couple of plastic patio chairs and a television, and it was just stunning. And people at school had an impression of Geelon because he was a star basketball player and everybody knew who he was. And so people had this impression that Geelon was big time. And the reality was Geelon was struggling. You know, he had a hard season the year I was there. He had some injuries, questions about how significant those injuries were. I believe, and I think the book makes clear, he did have tendonitis, no doubt about that. I think, you know, that from where his family was coming from, though, they were desperately worried that the tendonitis was something more and could have prevented him from playing college basketball, which for Geelon, it was a ticket out.
It was their big chance for the whole family, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you moved your whole family there for this season, the 2009-2010 season.
Correct. Yeah, we rented a house on the backside of a 15-acre horse farm in Georgetown, Kentucky.
So you follow them through that whole season. And it's much more than a story of one basketball season. It's the story of this small town and how almost every American current kind of rushes through it. The economy, for example.
Absolutely. So the year that I moved there was after the crash. Unemployment in Scott County, Kentucky was over 10% when I got there. They're the home base of a Toyota manufacturing plant that was also had fallen on hard times. And so the economy was certainly part of this story. And Scott County itself was part of this story. In fact, in my mind, there were six characters in this book. You know, the coach, four players, and Scott County itself. I never saw this book and still don't see this book as a sports book, a book about basketball. I see it as a book about a place, Kentucky, and more specifically, a rural slice of Kentucky.
Right. And there are other things that play into this as well. Big city problems are coming there. You know, it's a dry county. During the course of this book, they'll vote on whether or not to change that. Drugs as well. We think of small towns as isolated from these problems, but not anymore. And what are some of the other problems you saw as you were there?
Well, I think you touched on a couple of them. Obviously, the economy was big. The changes that were happening in Scott County were also big. Scott County is a county in transition. It's still very much rural, but it's only about 30 minutes from Lexington, which is the second largest city in Kentucky. And so it still imagines itself as a rural place, but it's a whole lot more urban than it used to be. And so it is at odds with itself constantly. And the battle over whether or not to sell alcohol on Sundays was certainly part of that.
And it's still politically conservative.
Absolutely. Scott County, Kentucky, voted for the Tea Party candidate Rand Paul in the Senate election that happened just months after this basketball season ended. Certainly, this was a time of rage and anger in America, politically, economically, and Scott County is a portrait of that, no doubt.
And also running through this is a portrait of what happens to high school athletes. You know, what kind of education do they get? How well prepared are they? What are the tensions of that adoration from their fellow students and vilification when they're not so successful? I mean, it's a real coming of age story of these guys. But still, even though you don't see this as a sports book, one of the great things about it is that you read through these pages of descriptions of basketball games, and they are page-turning wonders. You're rooting for these kids the whole way. So in some way, you had to draw on sports writing skills, right? That must have been fun for you.
It was fun, and it was also unnerving. You know, as someone who's read sports books, a lot of times what I find to be the least interesting is the story of the actual game. And so I wanted to make my book different in that respect. I really worked on making the games exciting and interesting because they were, in fact, exciting and interesting. And so obviously I was there for those games. I was recording in the Scott County locker room. And then for the majority of the Scott County games, I also received permission to record in the locker room of the opposing team. So that way, in the end result, I would have both locker rooms, both halftime speeches, both pregame speeches. You know, if the other team was celebrating because they beat Scott County, I had that. If the other team was shouting and falling apart because they'd lost to Scott County, I had that too.
Oh, Keith, the all-access pass back to high school. Well, it is a fabulous book. I'm wearing red in honor of your team today. I think most people who read this book will just love these people. I mean, they're so complex and interesting, and it's a wonderful American journey. So, you can meet Keith O'Brien when he signs Outside Shot Thursday, January 24th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you, Susan.
Landry, that rock star of New Orleans children's books, is back with book number 8, The Amazing Adventure of Mardi Gras Beat Dog. If you've ever seen Cornell read from Goodnight Nola or One Dat, Two Dat, Are You a Who Dat, you know that you'll see young readers lip-syncing or reading right along or just knowing the book by heart. So when Haydell's Bakery, beloved of king cake lovers and creators of the Mardi Gras Beat Dog, talked to Cornell about a new character for a new book, he was ready. Hi, Cornell.
Hey, Susan. How you doing?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, I get to talk to you for all the fun occasions.
Right, exactly.
Last time, it was football season.
Right.
For the tiger and the honey badger to pick on the zoo. Uh-huh. And now it's Mardi Gras.
It's Mardi Gras.
And congratulations are in order in another area because you've had a big event in your life since the last time I saw you.
I had a baby boy, my first boy, Cooper Crawford Landry, born on All Saints Day, November 1st.
Aw. So he'll be adding things to your work as you
exactly.
go along.
Exactly. I'll at least have to come up with another book just to put a dedication just to him in that one.
Mm-hmm. You've already done one book about Mardi Gras, Happy
Correct.
Mardi Gras.
Yes.
So what was the challenge in going back to that festive time for you?
Well, the interesting thing was Haydell's Bakery had contacted me, and I didn't really know the story too much behind their bead dog. So when Meredith Timberlake, that works for them, they contacted me and the Haydell brothers, we sat and brainstormed, and the premise behind it or that we wanted to do was the first kid who ever made a bead dog. So that was the idea. And so it's kind of set in the 60s because that's the transition period of when beads went from being glass beads to the plastic beads. So the story is of a little guy, Johnny Jester, who's all excited because it's Mardi Gras Day and he's running towards the Rex Parade and he stumbles upon a log and sees a pair of broken beads that he turns into a dog. So he gets all excited and he wants to show his friends. So he runs off to the parade and meets Mama Roo, a character like a New Orleans voodoo priestess type lady in St. Louis Cemetery Number 1. And he catches her and drops his bead dog. And when she picks it up, she puts some magic juju on it and turns it into the big bead dogs that you saw all over the city.
A little Mardi Gras magic is good for everybody.
A little Mardi Gras magic is great, yes.
Now, we struggle against this girls gone wild, you know, image of Mardi Gras.
Right.
And in your books, you're putting forth the way Mardi Gras really is for those of us who live here.
Exactly.
Talk about that a little bit, about your experience of, oh, say, what would be a perfect Mardi Gras day?
To me, a perfect Mardi Gras day is friends, family, on a neutral ground, wherever, with an ice chest full of adult beverages and a box of Popeye's chicken and maybe some donuts to start the morning off and, you know, just really with family. I guess it's transitioned through the years. High school, I did the high school thing, hanging out with all your friends in college, same thing. But Mardi Gras for New Orleanians is not Bourbon Street. You know, Bourbon Street has its, I did that. I managed nightclubs on Bourbon Street. So, you know, I had my time and my fair share with that. But yeah, I guess as I get older and with the children, it's, you want to keep them safe is the most important thing. So
what's the takeaway for this book? What do you want the young readers to take away from this?
I'd like for them just to be able to learn a little bit about, you know, some of the ones we have the history of Mardi Gras between my two books. But with the Bead Dog book, it's kind of just a magical little story where, at the end of it, he wakes up the next morning on Ash Wednesday, you know, which is a somber kind of day. And then he looks up and sees his little bead dog and he remembers back from the day before and wonders, hey, was it a dream or, you know, was it reality? But then at the end he says, well, as long as I have my little bead dog, every day is Carnival Day. So
And you have a spot where they can paint in their own B-Dog at the back of the book.
That's right, in the back of the book, right? There's a blank coloring page that my artist, Sean Gautreau, I have to give Sean a little props here because he did a great job on this one, too. No matter where you are, if you look at it, you can tell that it's a New Orleans theme book.
Oh, purple, green, and gold everywhere you look.
Everywhere, correct, yeah.
That's kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
You have to think about animating these now, you know?
Yeah, that would be interesting, yeah.
I think it would be. They have
a series at 8 now, huh? To animate each one.
Yeah, I think you better get to work on that. All right.
Sean, if you're listening.
Well, you can meet Cornell Landry, who is the man in New Orleans children's books.
Thanks, Susan.
Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at Octavia Books. And for those of you who really want to know the secret of his success, catch him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival Thursday, March 21st, doing a masterclass about self-publishing. For information about that, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thanks, Cornell.
Thanks, Susan.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lauren Godin and Romney Caruso signed their new book, New Orleans Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the French Quarter to the Garden District, Tuesday, January 22nd at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Kim Marie Vaz signs The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition, Tuesday, January 22nd at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. James Farwell signs Persuasion and Power, The Art of Strategic Communication, Wednesday, January 23rd at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Keith O'Brien signs Outside Shot, Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness, Thursday, January 24th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Rene Brunet and Jack Stewart sign There's One in Your Neighborhood, The Lost Movie Theaters of New Orleans, Thursday, January 24th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Cornell Landry reads from and signs The Amazing Adventure of Mardi Gras Bead Dog, Saturday, January 26th at 1 at Octavia Books. And Amy Bender's visit as the 2013 Zell Kimmerling Writer in Residence at Tulane University has been moved from March up to January. Bender, whose most recent novel is The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, will give a reading January 28th at 7 p.m. in the Freeman Auditorium at Tulane University. The Greater New Orleans Writing Project at the University of New Orleans invites teachers, literacy professionals, and school administrators to Write Fest 2013, an all-day conference focused on writing and creativity. It takes place Saturday, January 26th from 8:30 to 4 at the Lindy Boggs Conference Center and will feature Louisiana's leading teachers, as well as nationally renowned educator Barry Lane. Teachers or administrators interested in registering to attend should visit gnowp.org. The Lunch and Lit Group discusses The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander and Cornell West, Tuesday, January 29th at noon at the Keller Library Community Center. Jen Lancaster signs her new novel, Here I Go Again, Tuesday, January 29th at 6 o'clock at Garden District Bookshop. And don't forget to sign up to be a giver for World Book Night, that annual celebration dedicating to spreading the love of reading person to person. Each year, on April 23rd, tens of thousands of people distribute 500,000 free World Book Night paperbacks to light and non-readers in their communities. If you're interested in participating, sign up to be a giver at us.worldbooknight.org. The deadline is February 6th. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.